Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager. Carolyn Yeager brings you news and commentary on Holocaust revisionism, World War II history, free speech issues, and more. And now, here's Carolyn.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager. If you've been listening to my programs, you know I've been featuring a lot of detention camps. And the point I'm trying to get across is that a camp is a camp is a camp. The great differences that we're led to believe exist between bad German camps and good Allied camps, for example, has no basis except propaganda. In my opinion, whether we call it a detention camp, a labor camp, a concentration camp, a POW camp, or even a death camp, they all follow the same procedures and offer the same facilities for the most part, unless, of course, they are the Eisenhower camps for German surrendered persons that one of these days I'll talk about. But tonight, I'm going to talk about concentration camps in the USA during the 1940s that were built for the Japanese and Germans and Italian-born who were living here. Some were born here and therefore U.S. citizens. You might want to go to a website while this show is going on, if you're at your computer, a website that has some pictures that relate to who and what I'm going to be talking about and with whom. And this website is the German-American Internee Coalition. The URL is www.gaic.info/real, or R-E-A-L, what do you call that, underline, then F-U-H-R.html. I know that's long, but I hope you got that, or you can just Google German-American Internee Coalition. So, my guest is a man who knows this well, for he was an internee for 5 years in this USA system. That's longer than the United States was fighting in the war, I believe. He is Eberhard Fuhr of Palatine, Illinois, and one of the very few who has ever spoken about this dark chapter in U.S. history. Eberhard and I are friends. We've been friends for several years, and so I call him by his first name. A very warm welcome to you, Eberhard.
Well, it's good to talk with you again, Carolyn, and I really appreciate all the work you've done.
Well, thank you. The one who's done a lot of work is you, and we will get into that. As I intimated, you are one of the few who has spoken out and one of the first, and you're quite a, in fact, in a sense, a pioneer, one of the pioneers in this bringing to light these camps and just how they were and what happened. And it really, if you look into it, as I have done quite a bit, it's shocking. A lot of it is quite shocking. It surprises people don't know about it, and there seems to be a desire to keep it all hushed up. So what I'd like for you to do, Eberhard, is we'll go into some of all your activities in the last 10 years or so at the end of the program, but I'd like you to start out telling our listeners just what your life, kind of your life story, you know, from the beginning, how you arrived in the United States with your family, and fairly briefly, but then what happened to your family in the 1940s?
Okay, Carolyn, I was born in Germany in 1925 in a suburb of Cologne called Leverkusen clinic owned by the Bayer Aspirin people. Because of the chaotic times in the 20s, my parents elected to come to the United States, and so in 1928 I was brought to Cincinnati. My younger brother was born then in 1929, just in time for the Great Depression. I went to grade schools and Lutheran school from grades 1 through 8. And then I went to Woodward High School, which was an inner city high school in Cincinnati with about 4,000 students. It's a five-story quadrangle building covering an entire city block. And just recently it's been converted to the high school for performing arts. At Woodward, I lettered in football and baseball. And one of my classmates in Spanish was Ezra Charles, who became a heavyweight boxing champion of the world several years after graduation. But he was already a professional boxer when I knew him in high school. Of course, and I participated in certain German things in Cincinnati, like German American Day at the zoo or at the this big amusement park called Coney Island. I sang in a Kinderchor, which was directed by Doris Day's father, and Doris Day was in it. And the her family name is really Koppelhoff.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she was.
How interesting.
She left the group to join Les Paul's Band of Renown, and that's where she really learned how to sing and swing.
So she was really she's really German.
Oh, absolutely.
And, I didn't know that. Well, tell us about your mother and father too, just a little bit. Your how you said your father, I know, was a baker, and he was sponsored to come over here, and he was working as a baker. Is that right?
My father was a baker, and never had his own shop, but he did work for other bakers and hotels and things like that. His specialty was bread, mm-hmm. and making bread and yeast doughs and that kind of thing.
Well, why didn't people will ask this, Eberhard? Why didn't your parents why didn't they have you and your older brother become American citizens? Why were you still not an American citizen when you were in high school?
Well, my parents really never became citizens, and quite frankly, I don't think my father ever intended to become one, especially after going through the Great Depression. I think he always wanted to return to Germany, which meant that we as minors could not become citizens on our own. Until you reach majority.
Okay, so they couldn't have you become citizens if they weren't.
No, that's right.
Oh, see, I didn't really understand that.
You can only apply for that after you've reached majority, 21. In those days it was 21, now it might be 18 since then. But
okay, so it was not your doing or your fault or anything that you were still a citizen of Germany. While you were in high school, and you were, you know, you probably considered yourself, well, I don't know what you considered yourself, but it doesn't really matter. But because your parents participated in German-American activities and organizations a little bit, but nothing political, right?
No, not really. I was brought up to love Germany, my native country, but I was also brought up to love and honor the United States of America and to obey all its laws and that kind of thing. And when the flag passed by in a parade, I put my hand on my heart just like as my father did too, because mm-hmm. That's the right thing to do. You know, mm-hmm. if you're a guest in a country, you you respect the laws and obey them.
Okay, and then a war broke out, and you said I recently just heard a very funny story from you about the Civil Defense Bomb Squad at your high school. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, before that, though, Carolyn, in 1940, every alien in the United States, age 14 and over, had to register as an alien living in the United States. Mm-hmm. And there was something like 240,000 Germans that were registered then, and something like 600,000 Italians, and the rest of you know, it didn't matter from what country you were from, you had to register as long as you were 14 years of age and over. my registration number was 405-6849, and we had to carry a registration book like an internal passport with your photo and fingerprint in this booklet.
Well, that was 1941. Is that what you said?
That was 1940.
Isn't that right?
1940, okay. Over a year before the war.
Okay. Well, on this image I have here on the page that I told people about, there's the picture of your it's not a passport, this internal, well, alien internal passport. And it's stamped on that side February 23rd, 1942. What does that mean?
Well, that means that when the United States and Germany went to war, we had to take this booklet in, and it had to be covered with in red, and that's when they stamped this 1942 thingamabob into it.
Okay, so you actually got this card in 1940.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, of course, Pearl Harbor changed everybody's life. Ours, and everybody in the United States of America. And when the United States did get into the war with Germany, we had to turn in our shortwave radios, cameras, binoculars, things like that, and you were restricted from any air travel. Of course, we couldn't afford air travel anyway, but we had to turn in any kind of weapon, including long knives that might be useful, say, in the kitchen.
Oh. So you were considered now aliens that had to have special rules put about you, very similar to, to the way the Jews were treated in Germany when they were suspect as not being fully loyal.
That's right.
At the beginning of the 1933. You know, it was just a slow process, wasn't it, of saying, well, now we're going to put these restrictions on you, and now we're going to put those restrictions on you. And that's very much the way it happened with you.
Oh, absolutely. And if you took a trip more than 50 miles, you were supposed to call a local police department, tell them where you're going to go, what route you were going to take, and when you're coming back.
Okay,
in other words,
and so
when, I'm sorry. When Pearl Harbor happened, we became alien enemies, not just aliens.
Yes, you started out even before that, because there was a war, although the United States wasn't in it, and you started out being seen as an alien that needed to register and have these rules. But then in 41, December, then you became an alien enemy. Hmm?
Correct.
Wow. How could they make you? Well, because your nation was, they were at war with your nation. Okay. So go on then.
So, the war came out, and in at Woodward High School, since I was on a football team, they thought that possibly the German Air Force might bomb the Cincinnati with incendiary bombs. So on every floor of that five-story building, in every corner of that quadrangle building, there was a bucket of sand. And I was on the bomb squad, and we were instructed on what to do if an incendiary bomb came on that floor. We were supposed to douse it with these buckets of sand. But
there was only four buckets of sand on each floor?
Yeah,
or there was
on
more
each
than
corner
that.
Of the quadrangle building, right. There was one.
So that wasn't very
corner.
Much sand, was it?
But it was very fine sand. It was fine-grained sand, and I'm sure it would not have put out a bomb. But right. We were prepared.
But you boys were supposed to go and expose yourself to the bomb with your bucket of sand. This was their plan, huh?
But, you know, it was all part and parcel of a... And in your homeroom every week, you were expected to buy war stamps. You know, it was... Woodward was an inner-city school, so it was in the poor district. So we were kind of expected to buy 25 cents war stamps every Monday, which I did.
What about your teachers and fellow students? Because you, if they knew you were German and you had a German name, and your brother too, sort of, did you notice a change, or was everybody just real nice to you?
Well, actually, nobody really knew I was German. I didn't make a point of.
No, but you did have a German name, and sometimes even that was enough.
But you know, Cincinnati is. Was originally a German town anyway, and mm-hmm. So there were a lot of German names in Cincinnati. It was
wartime. So you were still feeling quite comfortable at school?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I lettered in football. I still have close buddies that I stay in touch with from the football team, and I lettered in baseball, and I played... summer baseball games and that kind of thing. And I just continued right in school.
Do you see this bomb squad... Oh, excuse me, I'm interrupting you, but I wanted to ask you, do you see this bomb squad business as being really anything effective, or was it just propaganda to make the students more aware, you know?
I think probably when you in retrospect, it probably is more propaganda than anything else. At this school, there was a 10-foot or an 8-foot wrought iron fence completely around this building. It was really beautiful, and it was torn down to contribute to the war effort, along with all of the Cincinnati streetcar tracks. They literally tore the steel tracks out of the streets.
Did they do that everywhere or just in Cincinnati?
Well, I don't know about everywhere, but they sure did it in Cincinnati because there was a lot of streetcars running in Cincinnati and they converted those to what they call trolley buses.
Mm-hmm.
So that they didn't need the tracks anymore. But the tracks were embedded in the street.
And they dug all that up because they thought they needed that iron or steel for armaments.
And we were encouraged to bring used pots and pans for the metal drives and that kind of thing.
Okay.
But in August of 1942, my mother and father were both arrested and they were almost immediately sent to Siegelville, Texas for internment. And my younger brother, who was 12 years old, had to go into an internment with them, even though he was born here, on the pain of either being interned or being placed into an orphanage. And so that was a Hobson's choice the folks didn't make, so they took him into internment. So my older brother and I lived in a home alone. And he went off to a football scholarship at Wittenberg College that fall in of 1942, and I lived alone in the house, and I forged my mother's signature for permission to play on the Woodward football team.
Now, you were 17 years old,
right.
And the government knew that they had taken your parents away. And they knew that you were living there. Well, they had been surveilling you for a long time. We'll have to go into that, too. Although that will come out when you give your... it'll come out later, I guess. So they were just continuing to watch you as you were living there alone and trying to finish high school, right?
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, it was probably late November one evening, about 7 o'clock... two FBI agents came to the house, and they asked me to go with them to the federal building downtown Cincinnati. And then they took me to this dark building, huge building, and interrogated me for a couple hours with one agent sitting behind his desk and the other guy sitting behind me, and he took his revolver out and started cleaning it and putting it back together and all those kind of things. And asked me all kinds of questions about the neighbors, what did they think about my parents being interned and things like that. And, of course, I didn't really ever discuss very much with anything with my neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
So I came in March of 1943. I was about 6 weeks short of graduation. And I was in my on the third floor of that building, and the principal, Dr. Peasley, came in and asked me to step in the hallway. He apologized, saying, I'm sorry, I have to ask you to step in the hallway. So the minute I stepped in the hallway, this one agent took my arm, and he said, we're going to take you into custody. So they took me down to my locker, and then I took out my light coat because it was a cool March. And outside the building, they handcuffed me. And by that time, my brother had left college, and he was working in a brewery in Cincinnati called Burger Brewery. And it was payday, so we went to the Burger Brewery, and he was arrested, too, and they took us down to the Hamilton County Workhouse, which is really a county prison. And I was 17 years old, so I'm confused about whether it was a three-tier prison or a five-tier on the inside, but anyway, it was huge. And we had to take off our clothes, and they gave us prison clothes without shoelaces and no belt, so we couldn't harm ourselves.
And so you were really dangerous,
yeah.
People, you and your younger.
So they put us in individual cells, and we were separated by I don't know how many cells, but the cells themselves were, it's really a medieval prison. And the bed was hung off the wall like in a bad cartoon with a chain. And the toilet was a galvanized bucket in the corner.
Can't believe that.
Boiling water. And, but they did bring drinking water periodically through the prison. And we were in single cells. And then these guards saying, hey, we got these two Nazis. What are we going to do with them tomorrow morning when we open these doors? You know, to go down to the mess hall for breakfast. And the next thing, oh man, I'll tell you, it was kind of one of the most frightening nights I ever spent in my life, because I've listened to all these threats about what they were going to do to us when
the other prisoners
were going to be released.
You mean
open in the morning?
The other prisoners started saying all these things.
Oh, yeah. It was...
they were egged on by the guards, huh?
They didn't know it until the guards told them that we were so-called Nazi prisoners, and they were literally inciting them to do violence to us, and it was kind of frightening. But fortunately, their bark was a lot worse than their bite, so... In the morning, they did open a cell. So you could go down and wash up, and they're all there, and they're all giving everybody. I don't know if they even knew who we were, but we went to this mess hall, and mess hall is the right word for that place because the food was totally inedible, anybody that ate was in there for longer than a week would certainly lose 10 pounds.
Wow. Well, all right, Eberhard, we're going to have to stop for a break now, but we will continue with the other incarceration places you got to enjoy when we come back. So stay with us, ladies and gentlemen.
We'll be right back with more on the Heretics Hour. You're listening to VOR. ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Pa- Palestinians in Jordan face accusations of extremism simply for voicing their frustration at the decades of deadlock in the Middle East. They were forced out of their homeland 62 years ago, and the governments of Jordan and Israel say the refugees are likely to turn to violence. But as Paula Smear found, there are others who say regional instability is being exaggerated by Israel and the US.
77-year-old Othman Balathmeh can hardly walk or hear, but he remembers every detail of that night in 1948, when as a teenager he and other panicking Palestinian refugees fled for the safety of Jordan during Israel's War of Independence. They left with nothing more than the clothes on their back, and 60 years on, they're still dreaming of returning.
My children have never seen Palestine, but I taught them that one day we will return. I promise them this. We'll accept nothing but the return to Palestine. No money, no compensation, no more empty promises.
Othman's son Arafat was born in Amman and grew up in Al-Bakr, the largest of the 13 Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan. He's never visited his father's village, which is today a thriving Israeli city. But he believes in the Quran, which he says promises it won't be long before he returns.
I think there is a new motion or a new movement to work not by speaking only. I think there is another steps to liberate our homeland, because the peace negotiation and other things related with these things cannot do anything for us.
The implication is clear, and authorities in Jordan fear that refugees like these are contributing to the growing terror threat. Over the last few years, dozens of people have been killed in attacks.
Ever since three hotels were simultaneously bombed in 2005, there have been major security checks at every official building. Experts say the terrorism was imported from abroad, and very little of it is homegrown.
But homegrown or not, it's on the increase, warns former Israeli Security Service Chief Danny Yotam.
If the Hashemite regime will not fight it the way they do it, it might become an existential threat to the kingdom, because we have to bear in mind that there are at least 2 million Palestinian refugees living in Jordan. Almost 100% of them, carry Jordanian passports. There are also close to 1 million Iraqi refugees.
But some Jordanian officials say the threat is exaggerated. They blame the Israelis and Americans for painting a false picture of regional instability.
United States have to justify its presence in the region, saying that every country in the region having extremism and terrorism. At the end of the day, if we don't have extremism and if they are not fighting terrorism, then what they are doing in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Today in Al-Bakr camp, one in five people is unemployed. It's hard to escape a sense of disillusionment growing and hope fading. No one here wants Jordan as their permanent home, but with no real answer of where is, below the surface the pressure cooker that is their life continues to boil, with the threat of one day exploding. Paul Islier, RT, Al-Bakr Refugee Camp, Jordan.
Let's return to the Heretics Hour, brought to you by VOR, ReasonRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I have my guest, Eberhard Furr, who is telling us about his rather frightening experiences after being arrested in 1943 from his high school, and then being in the custody of the U.S. government as considered to be an enemy alien. So, Eberhard, we were at the very first detention place that you were at in Cincinnati, and it's morning, and now you're going to tell us about the other places you were sent to.
Okay. But well, they took us to a hearing downtown Cincinnati, and my older brother went into the hearing room first. You're not allowed to have an attorney, and you certainly weren't allowed to have witnesses. And while he was in there, I read the very paper that I delivered on a regular route, the Cincinnati Inquirer, and it said two brothers are arrested and they will have a hearing and they will be interned. And they gave a history that my parents have already been interned the previous August. So when they called me in, there were something like five people there. There were no witnesses, and they would read off things like, did you say this 5 years ago about this or that? And of course, 5 years before that, I was only 12 years old, and I really couldn't remember.
And they did have a statement that you said something about Adolf Hitler. You mentioned Adolf Hitler. Somebody had reported
five years ago. You said something that favorable about Hitler, like he built good roads or something like that. And I said, well, I really don't remember what I said when I was 12. Then there was one of the hearing board members said, now, we know you have cousins in Germany, and one of whom has really been active in the Hitler Youth, and we believe he's probably in the military now, and he's just about your age, and maybe a little bit older. He said, now, if he came to you one night and after coming up from a submarine on the Ohio River, what would you tell him at 2 o'clock in the morning? And I figured, well, holy mackerel, I said, I remembered my Mark Twain, and the Mark Twain meaning that the river only drew maybe 12 feet, and I said, well, I don't think the submarine could come up the Mississippi and then the Ohio, and at that point, they thought I was kind of a smart aleck, and that was kind of the high point of the hearing, and so the hearing concluded pretty quickly after that. And we were taken to our home and said, take enough clothes for 2 days and make sure the windows are locked. So they took us back to the prison. And that was the last time we ever saw the house because it was later looted and then we lost it to foreclosure. And the following morning, they shackled us and then they drove us up to a detention station in Chicago, Illinois. There were, about 37 German, Hungarian, and Italians waiting for adjudication of their hearings or being shipped to different internment camps around the place. And we were there for 3 months, and it was an old mansion, so it could accommodate maybe four or five guys to a bedroom. And it was refurbished and resold last year for about $2.5 million. Then in July, the immigration people opened this new family camp in Crystal City, Texas, and they sent us down there. And that was about a huge place of probably about a quarter of a mile each on each leg of the of the compound, with a 10-foot fence and guard towers and all those kind of good things. And but we were able to live as family units in this facility. And half the place was Japanese, and there was one Italian civil engineer from the Honduras, from Central America. He actually designed a swimming pool, which we induced the authorities to permit us to build with all these kids down there. It was a great thing in all that heat.
The pool, though, wasn't ready until close to the end of the war, wasn't it? Sometime in 1944 that the pool finally opened?
But probably the end of 1944, and mm-hmm. two Japanese girls died. Drowned in that pool, and on one of the hottest days of the year, and with all, there were paid guards and all that kind of stuff to assure against it, and wall to wall people because it was so hot.
There was Crystal City, Texas is in South Texas. I'm familiar with that place, it's a hellhole hot when in the summer, particularly.
It's 105 miles southwest of San Antonio, pretty mm-hmm. close to the Mexican border.
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that grows there are pear cactus and mesquite trees.
Yes.
And a lot of bugs and insects and that kind of thing.
Scorpions, yeah. You said, lots of scorpions.
And scorpions. And we lived in buildings that were probably a little bit better than Tar Shack, but they were totally uninsulated, so they could really get hot. And living in a family unit, your mother cooked on a two-burner kerosene stove. And I got a job for 10 cents an hour delivering ice to the ice boxes in each family unit, which enabled me to get outside of the camp, too. And I'm probably the only guy in the world who learned how to drive it while he was interned, because we didn't have a family car before I was interned. And this ice crew guy, who was a German from Panama, interned there with his Panamanian family, and he taught me how to drive that ice truck.
Yes. Okay. So now we had here the Japanese sections, and then we had the German sections, and then there was were the Italians with the Germans, or were the Italians separated into their own section?
We were not segregated as such. We could co-mingle. We used the same facilities, the same hospital, and the medical care was certainly good.
Yes, I have a map here of it, and I mean a diagram, and it looks like the fence goes all the way around, but inside there were no fences?
Inside there were no fences, no.
Okay.
And we were glad that the Japanese were there, because we were able to play softball against them, because we could only field one softball team, and they could field five or six. And we mm-hmm. played basketball against them, and soccer. When mm-hmm. they brought up the Japanese from Peru, the American Japanese couldn't play soccer, but the Peruvian Japanese could. And there were a bunch of a lot of Germans from Central and South America too that were brought there for internment from Central and South America.
Yeah, I see. There's a soccer field, and of course, like in all these camps, that's what happens. There's sports, and of course, this being with so many kids there, you needed the sports, plus you had schools, and you all
right.
went to school. And what would you say, what was the quality of your school? Were your teachers fellow inmates, or were they from the outside, or what?
Well, there were really three schools. There was a German school, a Japanese school, and the state of Texas school. The German school had German teachers, not all of whom were qualified. Now, I mean, they were kind of pressed into service before the state put a school in for Americans run by the state. And the Japanese had the same setup for their people, where they could learn the Japanese language, and in the German school you learn the German language. And of course, for our side, they also learned Spanish too, because we had so many people from Central and South America.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I met my wife-to-be there, and she graduated from Federal High School, the American school, in Crystal City in 1946. A year after the war was over, she graduated from Federal High School.
Okay. But did you graduate from high school while you were there?
Well, you know, I was 6 weeks short of graduation at Woodward High School.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I even expunged my picture from the yearbook. But I really didn't. It was only after I was released and I took some tests that I got my diploma.
Well, you mean they had a Texas State school there, but you weren't able
go.
To. You just didn't go. You just chose not to go to it?
Yeah, I was kind of bummed out, so I didn't go.
Yeah. Okay, I get you. All right. So how long were you in Crystal City?
I was in Crystal City from July of 1943 until April of 1947.
And let me real quick tell the listeners that there is a lot of information and pictures of Crystal City and of what things look like, and it wasn't very nice, really. They make it look better than it is in their little some of their talk, but it wasn't very nice. But people didn't die, you know, from it. And people want to just Google and look for that on the internet. They can find quite a bit. So, all right, sorry. Continue, Eberhard. Please.
So, in April of 1947, the family was sent to Ellis Island to be deported under President Truman's Proclamation Number 2655, who declared that we were to be deported. In the meantime, a Herman Schleuder in New York filed a case in court asking for habeas corpus and saying that at his hearing, since he was deprived of a lawyer, he was improperly interned because of the defective way that hearing was held, and he lost his case by the lower court. He appealed it to the Circuit Court of Appeals, which on January the 2nd, 1947, affirmed the lower court, saying that Schleuder was properly denied habeas corpus, and he could not dispute the quality of his hearing because he wasn't entitled to a hearing in the first place. So all of our legal options were gone unless we got to the Supreme Court, and that was an impossibility. And the executive wanted us gone too. But on Ellis Island, suddenly Senator Langer from North Dakota convened a subcommittee on the judiciary, and he granted us all a hearing. And on July the 27th of 1947, and he instituted a bill called S-1749, which was rendered moot by later developments, in which he demanded that the Attorney General, Tom C. Clark, immediately release the 280 of us listed on that bill, and I'm listed on page 2 of that. So in September 1947, I was released. And then after that, I got my, I wrote to my principal at Woodward High, and I said I'd like to get my diploma, and they mailed some tests to Englewood High School in New Jersey, at which I took the three finals, and I don't think they ever read it because they just gave me my Woodward High School diploma.
Wow, that was nice. Okay, so well, I guess you explained it sufficiently, but overall, why did they keep you and your family so long after the war was over?
That's really the burning question, and it's almost like there was a certain rage against the family. Like when the Cincinnati fire marshal said that the house had been looted and everything is strewn about, and what are you going to do about it? And the letter came to the authorities in Crystal City, Texas, and my father said, "Well, I'll go there to board it up and make it safe for the surrounding people." They said, "Well, you can do that, Mr. Fuhrer, except that you'll have to pay for three guards and all of their expenses to and from while you do this." And here's a man that made $35 a week as a baker.
And now he had nothing. Yeah.
It's unreal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there was a lot of hatred. Well, we know that. Okay. Would you like to say what you did when you were released, and how you got involved in what you're doing with this now?
Well, after I got released, I got married to the gal I met in Crystal City, and she was a great secretary, and she put me through school. I only had to work during the summertime, and we had 56 good years together before she died 6 years ago. And three kids and something like eight grandchildren. And when I retired, I determined that I really had nothing else. I didn't do anything while I was working because I didn't want to jeopardize my career.
Mm-hmm.
And but when I did retire, I became very active after I learned about Art Jacobs down in in his website, www.forwardtimes.
Yeah, and, would you spell that as the F-O-I-C?
F-O-I-T-I-M-E-S, right.
Okay, F-O-I Times, okay.
Yeah, Forward Times.
Yeah, great website. People can go there. I'll put these on the program page.
He was very active in it, and I got active in it, and I just remembered how much my mother lost all of those worthless things, but totally priceless, that meant so much to her. And they even meant more than the house, really. So that I just thought I owed it to her and to my American-born brother who had to go into an internment let people know what really happened. And I lecture now wherever I can. I've probably talked to maybe 7,000 people in the last 3 or 4 years about internment. I make no charges for my lectures. I pay all my own expenses. And it's because I just feel that I have to do it. And
well, you also are in the effort to have Congress recognize the internment of the Germans, which they have recognized and compensated the Japanese, but they refuse to do it with the Germans. They just keep ignoring this. And yet you say that you yourself would not accept a dime, which I don't really agree with. I think that's far too honorable, but you don't want any money, but you know that you want the recognition, which they don't give.
Well, I'm kind of strange that way. I do not want the money because the losses that I didn't really have anything to lose. I didn't have a job, but the people that the guys that were interned and the women who were interned who had jobs, they had families, they had homes. A lot of them had careers they could never get back into.
Mm-hmm.
They're the ones that lost things, and anybody can use $20,000 for whatever purpose, but for me, I really don't want to take it. I feel just better not taking it.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about this internee reunion that's coming up? You're encouraging former internees to get together and reunite and so on, correct?
We are kind of a dwindling number, and we are going to have a reunion on August the 28th in Quakertown, Pennsylvania. The address is 1960 Rosedale Road in Quakertown, Pennsylvania. It's between Allentown and Philadelphia. And we're asking for any internees that would like to come in will be served at 1 o'clock on August the 28th, but there won't be any formal presentations because all of the guys were interned. They know what happened, but we will have some DVDs there in case their kids or relatives aren't quite up to date on internment, and so everybody should come on August the 28th to 1960. Rosedale Road in Quakertown.
Right. If anybody listening wants, they can email me at the email address on the program page, and I will send off information about it just in case anybody's listening. And
yeah, and we'd like to know who's coming so we can have enough food and things like that, too.
Okay. Very good. So we took care of some of that. I wanted to make sure we got that in. You know, I have in front of me the warrant that was made out for you, for Eberhard Ernst Frederick Furr, and it was made out in 1941, December 8th, right, at Pearl Harbor. And it was signed by Francis Biddle, the Attorney General. So they arranged a warrant for you at that time, and then that date, 1941, is crossed out, and we have they put in place March 8th, 1943, the day they actually did come to arrest you. What does that signify?
Well, I think it signifies they just got these things in the file. All they got to do is whip it out and put the right date on it. You know, the Assistant Attorney General of the United States, James Rowe, testified later on that shortly after Pearl Harbor, 60,000, mostly Germans, were arrested and were given hearings at 90 different hearing boards. And as I said just a moment ago, the Circuit Court of Appeals said, hey, those hearings were meaningless. They were totally meaningless hearings. Mm-hmm. And they had all these guys who were doing their job for the United States at war effort, probably at $1 a year, who gave up valuable time to demand these hearing boards. And then you find out in 1947 that the hearings they've been giving since 1941 are totally meaningless. It's ridiculous.
Yeah. You know, another thing that I just remembered was that at Ellis Island, you know, I've talked about Ellis Island on this program before in a different, little bit different context of the people who were coming in and how they were treated for diseases and quarantine and so on, treated very much like the incoming prisoners at Auschwitz. And I would like you to tell a little bit more about what it was like at Ellis Island. You said it wasn't very good there.
Well, Ellis Island is... The men are separated from the women. The women were on a different level, and the guys were on another level.
So your family was separated once you got to Ellis Island?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, my mother was totally separated.
Okay.
She had to be with the women. And the facilities for... You lived in huge dormitories with two-level bunk beds, and the food was terrible. Every Thursday, I think it was, you had... the menu was tripe for dinner, and I still don't know what tripe really is, but there was very little opportunity for exercise, and you could just, from your window, you could see the back of the Statue of Liberty. The statue turns her back on people that are on Ellis Island. And the day the man said, you're free to go, I was gone in 20 minutes. I took that ferry 20 minutes after the man told me that I was free to go. I did not wait for my train ticket back to Cincinnati.
Well, did you leave with the rest of your family, or were you by then just sort of on your own?
I left my family on the island. I left. I didn't want them to change their mind.
So your family hadn't been released yet, or they just didn't leave that fast, huh?
They left the next day. On the train.
Wow, so you really had it, hadn't you?
Yeah, I had it.
Yeah, and
I would do the same thing again.
Yes. And, you know, and then so many who went through what you went through refused to talk about it, don't want to talk about it, won't say a word about it. And this is what you face, right?
Yeah, it's kind of cathartic. It's cathartic, really. And it's kept me busy, and... I'm really the sole survivor of the family, and I'm really the only one that talked about it. In fact,
Well, that's what I'm trying to say. I'm trying to say that so many, not just your family, but all kinds of them, they won't talk about it. The Germans, they don't want to talk about it. And that seems to be something that has to do with everything that the Germans went through during the war. Germans in Germany and here, they just want to put it behind them. But you are willing to speak out. I'm so glad you are. I mean, you know, we have come to the end of the program, Eberhard. You know, I admire you very much. I'm so glad that you have talked about this, because if people like you didn't, we wouldn't know what we know today. And also Art Jacobs, who is a friend of yours and who has been a real hero about all of this. He had his own terrible experiences. And I hope people go to see his website, FOI Times. Just look up Art Jacobs, FOI Times, and you'll find it. Well, there's a great deal we could say about all this, but I think we covered quite a bit, and so I want to thank you so much for being my guest.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, we'll talk again. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. Good night for now.
Thanks for listening. The Heretics Hour returns Monday evening, 9 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.